The Gulag Archipelago, 1918 to 1956. An experiment in literary investigation by Alexander I. Solzhenitsyn. Translated by Thomas P. Whitney. Copyright 1973 by Alexander I. Solzhenitsyn. English language translation, copyright 1973-1974 by Harper and Row Publishers, Incorporated. This recording of the reading of the Gulag Archipelago was published by arrangement with Harper and Row Publishers, Incorporated, and was produced in 1989 by Blackstone Audiobooks, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any part thereof may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Blackstone Audiobooks, Incorporated. The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2. This volume is 672 pages long and contains two parts. The Destructive Labor Camps, which consists of 22 chapters, and The Soul and Barbed Wire, which consists of 4 chapters. The volume will be read in 2 sections. The first will take us through Chapter 9 of The Destructive Labor Camps. The second will pick up with Chapter 10 and take us to the end of Volume 2. And now, The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2.
The Destructive Labor Camps. The author makes the following note to preface Chapter 1. There is no limit to what should be included in this part. To attain and encompass its savage meaning, one would have to drag out many lives in the camps, the very same in which one cannot survive for even one term, without some special advantage, because they were invented for destruction. And from this it follows that all those who drank of this most deeply, who explored it most fully, are already in their graves and cannot tell us. No one now can ever tell us the most important thing about these camps. And the whole scope of this story and of this truth is beyond the capabilities of one lonely pen. All I had was a peephole into the archipelago, not the view from a tower. But fortunately several other books have emerged, and more will emerge. In the Kolyma stories of Shalamov, the reader will perhaps feel more truly and surely the pitilessness of the spirit of the archipelago, and the limits of human despair. To taste the sea, all one needs is one gulp. Chapter 1. The Fingers of Aurora. Rosy-fingered Haos, so often mentioned in Homer and called Aurora by the Romans, caressed, too, with those fingers, the first early morning of the archipelago. When our compatriots heard via the BBC that M. Mihailov claimed to have discovered that concentration camps had existed in our country as far back as 1921, many of us, and many in the West too, were astonished. That early, really? Even in 1921? Of course not. Of course Mihailov was in error. In 1921, in fact, concentration camps were already in full flower, already even coming to an end. It would be far more accurate to say that the archipelago was born with the shots of the cruiser Aurora. And how could it have been otherwise? Let us pause to ponder. Didn't Marx and Engels teach that the old bourgeois machinery of compulsion had to be broken up and a new one created immediately in its place? And included in the machinery of compulsion were the army. We are not surprised that the Red Army was created at the beginning of 1918. The police, the militia was inaugurated even sooner than the army, the courts from November the 22nd, 1917, and the prisons. How, in establishing the dictatorship of the proletariat, could they delay with a new type of prison? That is to say that it was altogether impermissible to delay in the matter of prisons, whether old or new. In the first months after the October Revolution, Lenin was already demanding the most decisive, draconic measures to tighten up discipline. And are draconic measures possible without prison? What new could the proletarian state contribute here? Lenin was feeling out new paths. In December 1917, he suggested for consideration the following assortment of punishments. Confiscation of all property, confinement in prison, dispatch to the front, and forced labor for all who disobey the existing law. Thus we can observe that the leading idea of the archipelago, forced labor, had been advanced in the first month after the October Revolution. And even while sitting peacefully among the fragrant hay mowings of Radzliff and listening to the buzzing bumblebees, Lenin could not help but ponder the future penal system. Even then he had worked things out and reassured us. The suppression of the minority of exploiters by the majority of the hired slaves of yesterday is a matter so comparatively easy, simple, and natural that it is going to cost much less in blood, will be much cheaper for humanity, than the preceding suppression of the majority by the minority. According to the estimates of émigré professor of statistics Kurganov, this comparatively easy internal repression cost us, from the beginning of the October Revolution up to 1959, a total of 66 million lives. We, of course, cannot vouch for his figure, but we have none other that is official. And just as soon as the official figure is issued, the specialists can make the necessary critical comparisons. It is interesting to compare other figures. How large was the total staff of the central apparatus of the terrifying Tsarist Third Department, which runs like a strand through all the great Russian literature? At the time of its creation, it had 16 persons, and at its height, it had 45. A ridiculously small number for even the remotest Cheka provincial headquarters in the country. Or how many political prisoners did the February Revolution find in the Tsarist Prison of the Peoples? All these figures do exist somewhere. In all probability, there were more than 100 such prisoners in the Kresty prison alone, and several hundred returned from Siberian exile and hard labor, and how many more were languishing in the prison of every provincial capital. But it is interesting to know exactly how many. Here is a figure for Tambov, taken from the fiery local papers. The February Revolution, which opened wide the doors of the Tambov prison, found there political prisoners in the number of 7 persons, and there were more than 40 provinces. It is superfluous to recall that from February to July 1917, there were no political arrests, and after July, the number imprisoned could be counted on one's fingers. Here, however, was the trouble. The first Soviet government was a coalition government, and a portion of the people's commissariats had to be allotted, like it or not, to the left SRs, including, unhappily, the People's Commissariat of Justice, which fell to them. Guided by rotten petty bourgeois concepts of freedom, this People's Commissariat of Justice brought the penal system to the verge of ruin. The sentences turned out to be too light, and they made hardly any use at all of the progressive principle of forced labor. In February 1918, the chairman of the Council of People's Commissars, Comrade Lenin, demanded that the number of places of imprisonment be increased, and that repression of criminals be intensified. And in May, already going over to concrete guidance, he gave instructions that the sentence for bribery must be not less than 10 years of prison and 10 years of forced labor in addition. That is a total of 20 years. This scale might seem pessimistic at first. Would forced labor really still be necessary after 20 years? But we know that forced labor turned out to be a very long-lived measure, and that even after 50 years it would still be extremely popular. For many months after the October Revolution, the prison personnel everywhere remained Tsarist. The only new officials named were commissars of prisons. The brazen jailers went so far as to create their own trade union, the Union of Prison Employees, and established an elective basis for prison administration, the only time in all Russian history. The prisoners were not to be left behind either. They too had their own internal self-government. Circular of the People's Commissariat of Justice, April the 24th, 1918. Prisoners, wherever possible, were to be brought into self-verification and self-supervision. Naturally, such a free commune of convicts, anarchical licentiousness, did not correspond to the needs of the dictatorship of the progressive class, and was of sorry help in purging harmful insects from the Russian land. And what could one expect if the prison chapels had not been closed, and our Soviet prisoners were willingly going there on Sundays, even if only to pass the time? Of course, even the Tsarist jailers were not entirely a loss to the proletariat, for after all theirs was a profession important to the most immediate purposes of the revolution. And therefore it was necessary to select those persons of the prison administration who have not become totally calloused and stupefied in the patterns of Tsarist prisons. And what does not totally mean? And how would you find that out? Does it mean they had forgotten God save the Tsar? Who can be used for work at the new tasks? Did they, for example, answer precisely, yes, sir, and no, sir, or turn the key in the lock quickly? And, of course, the prison buildings themselves, their cells, their bars and locks, although in appearance they remained exactly as before, in actual fact had acquired a new class content, a lofty revolutionary meaning. And, nevertheless, the habit of the courts, right up to the middle of 1918, of keeping right on, out of inertia, sentencing to prison, slowed the breakup of the old machinery of state in its prison area. In the middle of 1918, to be exact on July the 6th, an event took place whose significance is not grasped by everyone, an event superficially known as the suppression of the revolt of the left SRs. But this was, in fact, a coup d'etat of hardly any less significance than October the 25th. On October the 25th, the power, the government, of the Soviet of Workers' and Peasants' Deputies was proclaimed, whence the name Soviet Power. But in its first month, this new government was very much beclouded by the presence in it of other parties besides the Bolsheviks. Although the coalition government consisted only of the Bolsheviks and the left SRs, nonetheless, in the membership of the All-Russian Congresses, the second, third, and fourth, and of the All-Russian Central Executive Committees, VTSIKs, which they elected, there were still included some representatives of other socialist parties, SRs, Social Democrats, Anarchists, Popular Socialists, etc. Because of this fact, the VTSIKs possessed the unhealthy character of socialist parliaments. But in the course of the first months of 1918, by a whole series of decisive measures supported by the left SRs, the representatives of the other socialist parties were either expelled from VTSIK by its own decision and original parliamentary procedure, or else were simply not allowed to be elected to it. The last non-Bolshevik party, which still constituted one-third of the parliament, the Fifth Congress of Soviets, was the left SRs. And the time finally came to get rid of them, too. On July the 6th, 1918, they were excluded in toto from VTSIK and from the Council of People's Commissars. Thereby, the power of the Soviet of Deputies, by tradition called the Soviet, ceased to stand in opposition to the will of the Bolshevik Party and took the form of the democracy of a new type. Only on this historic day could the reconstruction of the old prison machinery and the creation of the archipelago really begin. In the clumsily high-flying language of Vyshinsky, the process, unique in the world, possessing genuine universal historical significance, of creating, on the ruins of the bourgeois system of prisons, those houses of the dead, which were built by the exploiters for the workers of new institutions with new social content. A.Y. Vyshinsky, editor, From Prisons to Rehabilitative Institutions, Moscow, Sovetskoye Zakonodatelstvo, Publishing House, 1934, Preface. And the direction of this desired reconstruction had long since been understood. After all, Marx himself had pointed out in his Critique of the Gotha Program that productive labor was the only method of prisoner correction. It was clear, of course, as Vyshinsky explained much later on, that what was meant here was not that kind of work which dries out the mind and the heart of a human being, but the miracle worker, which transforms people from non-existence and insignificance into heroes. Why is it that our prisoner must not chew the rag or read nice little books in a cell, but must labor instead? Because, in the Republic of the Soviets, there can be no place for forced idleness, for that forced parasitism which could exist in a parasitical society. For example, in Schlüsselburg. Such idleness as this on the part of prisoners would have very simply been contrary to the basis of the work structure of the Soviet Republic, as defined in the Constitution of July the 10th, 1918. He who does not work does not eat. Consequently, if the prisoners were not set to work, they were, according to the Constitution, to be deprived of their bread ration. The Central Penal Department of the People's Commissariat of Justice, which had been created in May 1918, had immediately begun to send off to work the then existing Zeks, began to organize productive labor. After the Brest-Litovsk peace, the left SRs left the government, and the People's Commissariat of Justice was headed by Bolsheviks. But this legislation had been proclaimed only after the July coup, to be precise, on July the 23rd, 1918, in Temporary Instructions on Deprivation of Freedom. These instructions continued to exist during the whole course of the Civil War, right up until November 1920. Those deprived of freedom who are capable of labor must be recruited for physical work on a compulsory basis. One can say that the camps originated and the archipelago was born from this particular instruction of July the 23rd, 1918, 9 months after the October Revolution. Someone may enter a reproach that the birth was premature. The necessity of forced labor by prisoners, which was anyway quite clear for everyone by then, was further clarified at the 7th All-Union Congress of the Soviets. Labor is the best means of paralyzing the disintegrating influence of the endless conversations of prisoners among themselves, in the course of which the more experienced instruct the newcomers. Aha! So that's why. Soon after that, there began the communist Subotniki, Voluntary Saturdays, and that same People's Commissariat of Justice issued an appeal. It is essential to teach the prisoners to become accustomed to communist collective labor. In other words, the spirit of the communist Subotniki was to be applied to the forced labor camps. And that is how that hasty epoch instantly heaped up a mountain of problems, which it took decades to sort out. The bases of corrective labor policy were included in the party program at the 8th Congress of the Russian Communist Party, March 1919. The complete organizational structuring of the camp network throughout Soviet Russia coincided rigidly with the first communist Subotniki, April the 12th to May the 17th, 1919. The decrees of VTSIK on camps for forced labor were issued on April the 15th, 1919, and May the 17th, 1919. Under their provisions, camps for forced labor were obligatorily created by the provincial Cheka in each provincial capital, if convenient within the city limits, or in a monastery or on a nearby country estate, and also in several counties as well, although for the time being not in all of them. The camps were required to accommodate no fewer than 300 persons each, in order that the cost of the guard and the administration should be paid for by the prisoners' labor, and they were under the jurisdiction of the provincial penal department. The early forced labor camps seem to us nowadays to be something intangible. The people imprisoned in them seem not to have said anything to anyone. There is no testimony. Literature and memoirs, when they speak of war communism, recall executions and prisons, but do not have a thing to say about camps. And nowhere, even between the lines, nowhere outside the text, are they implied. So it was natural for Mihailo Mihailov to make his mistake. Where were those camps? What were their names? What did they look like? The instruction of July the 23rd, 1918, had the decisive fault, noted by all jurists, that nothing was mentioned there about class differentiation among the prisoners. In other words, that some prisoners should be maintained in better conditions and some in worse. but it did outline the labor system. And that is the only reason we can get any picture of what they were like. The workday was set at 8 hours. Because of the novelty of it all, the hasty decision was made to pay the prisoners for all their work, other than camp maintenance, at 100% of the rates of the corresponding trade unions. Oh, what a monstrous thing. The pen can hardly bear to write it. They were being compelled to work by the Constitution, and they were also being paid according to the same Constitution. Logical enough. It is true that the cost of maintenance of the camp and the camp guard was deducted from their wages. For conscientious prisoners, there was a special benefit to be allowed to live in a private apartment and to come to the camp for work only. And release ahead of term was promised as a reward for special labor enthusiasm. And in general, there were no detailed instructions on the regimen, and every camp had its own. In the period of building a new governmental system, taking into account the great overcrowding of places of confinement, my italics, A.S. There was no time to think about the regimen in the camps. All the attention was being directed to unburdening the prisons. Something like that reads like a hieroglyphic from Babylon. How many questions immediately suggest themselves? What was going on in those wretched prisons? And what were the social causes of such overcrowding? And is one to understand the matter of unburdening the prisons to mean executions or dispatching prisoners to camps? And what did it mean by saying it was impossible to give any thought to the regimen in the camps? Did this mean that the People's Commissariat of Justice did not have time to safeguard the prisoner against the arbitrary actions of the local camp chief? Is that the only way this can be read? There were no instructions about the regimen, and in the years of the revolutionary sense of justice, every petty tyrant could do just as he pleased with the prisoners. From the meager statistics, all from that very same collection, Soviet Justice, we learn, in general, the work in camps was menial. In 1919, only 2.5% of the prisoners worked in workshops, and in 1920, only 10%. It is also known that at the end of 1918, the Central Penal Department, what a moniker, it makes the flesh creep, sought the establishment of agricultural colonies. It is known that in Moscow several brigades made up of prisoners were established to carry out repairs on water pipes, heating systems, and plumbing in nationalized buildings. And these apparently unescorted prisoners wandered about with monkey wrenches, soldering irons, and pipes through the corridors of government organizations and institutions in the apartments of the bigwigs of those times, summoned by their wives by telephone to carry out repairs, and were never mentioned in any memoir, in any play, or in any film. But the forced labor camps were nonetheless not the first camps in the RSFSR. The reader has already read the term concentration camp, Konzlager, several times in the sentences of the tribunals, part 1, chapter 8, and concluded perhaps that we were guilty of an error, of making careless use of terminology subsequently developed. No, this is not the case. In August 1918, several days before the attempt on his life by Fanya Kaplan, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin wrote in a telegram to Yevgenia Bosch and to the Penza Provincial Executive Committee, they were unable to cope with a peasant revolt, lock up all the doubtful ones, not guilty, mind you, but doubtful, A.S., in a concentration camp outside the city. To this now-forgotten woman was entrusted at this time, via the line of authority of the Central Committee of the Party and of the Cheka as well, the fate of all Penza province. And, in addition, carry out merciless mass terror. This was before the decree. Only on September the 5th, 1918, 10 days after this telegram, was the decree on the Red Terror published, which was signed by Petrovsky, Kursi, and Bronch-Brujevich. In addition to the instructions on mass executions, it stated in particular, secure the Soviet Republic against its class enemies by isolating them in concentration camps. So that is where this term, concentration camps, was discovered and immediately seized upon and confirmed, one of the principal terms of the 20th century, and it was to have a big international future. And this is when it was born, in August and September 1918. The word itself had already been used during World War I, but in relation to POWs and undesirable foreigners. But here, in 1918, it was for the first time applied to the citizens of one's own country. The switch in meaning is easily comprehended. Concentration camps for POWs were not prisons, but a necessary precautionary concentration of the POWs. And so, too, for doubtful compatriots, extrajudicial precautionary concentration was now proposed. For an energetic mind which could visualize barbed wire surrounding prisoners who had not been tried, the necessary term was right at hand, concentration camps. And while the forced labor camps of the People's Commissariat of Justice belonged to the category of general places of confinement, the concentration camps were in no sense general places, but were under the direct administration of the Cheka and were maintained for particularly hostile elements and for hostages. True, in the future, prisoners would be sent to concentration camps by tribunals as well. But people never tried, kept pouring in automatically, sent there only on the basis of hostility. For escape from a concentration camp, the sentence was multiplied by 10, also without trial. This was in tune with the times, 10 for one, 100 for one. Consequently, if a prisoner had a 5-year sentence and escaped and was caught, then his sentence was automatically extended to 1968. For a second escape from a concentration camp, execution was prescribed, and of course was punctiliously carried out. In the Ukraine, concentration camps were created somewhat later, in 1920. But the creative thinking of our young Soviet justice did not content itself with this. Very shortly, even the concentration camps, which would seem to have had a firm class foundation, came to be considered insufficiently severe, insufficiently purposeful. In 1921, the Northern Special Purpose Camps were founded. Not for nothing was that label special attached to them. They had as their acronym SLON. The first such camps arose in Pertominsk, Kolmogory, and just outside Archangel itself. The magazine Solovetskie Ostrova, the Solovetsky Islands, 1930, number 2-3, page 55. From the report of the Chief of Administration of SLON, Comrade Nogtev, in Chem, when nowadays tourists are shown the so-called Camp of the Government of Tchaikovsky at the mouth of the Dvina River, one would have to be in the know to realize that this was one of the first northern special purpose camps. However, these places were evidently considered difficult to guard and unsuitable for large concentrations of prisoners, and the gaze of the higher-ups naturally fell on the nearby Solovetsky Islands, Solovki, where their already built-up establishments and their stone buildings, located 12 to 25 miles from the mainland, sufficiently close for the jailers and sufficiently distant to discourage escapees, with no communication with the mainland for half the year, a harder nut to crack than Sakhalin. And once Solovki had been selected and established, recollections of the forced labor camps, the concentration camps, and the special purpose camps vanished from the popular mind. Because Solovki was not kept secret in the 20s, and in actual fact, ears buzzed with Solovki. They openly used Solovki to scare people with. They were publicly proud of Solovki. They had the brass to be proud of it. Solovki was even a symbol. There were as many jokes about it in vaudeville acts as you can imagine. After all, classes had already disappeared. Whither? And Solovki itself was soon to come to an end. Subscriptions to the internal camp magazine, the Solovetsky Islands, were boldly sold throughout the Soviet Union. But the camp rootlets went deeper, deeper, and it is simply that we have lost count of their places and traces. There is no one now to tell us about most of those first concentration camps, and only from the last testimony of those few surviving first concentration camp inmates can we glean and preserve a little bit. At that time, the authorities used to love to set up their concentration camps in former monasteries. They were enclosed by strong walls, had good solid buildings, and they were empty. After all, monks are not human beings and could be tossed out at will. Thus, in Moscow, there were concentration camps in Andronikov, Novospassky, and Ivanovsky monasteries. in the Petrograd Krasnaya Gazeta of September the 6th, 1918, we can read that the first concentration camp will be set up in Nizhny Novgorod in an empty nunnery, and initially it is planned to send 5,000 persons to the concentration camp in Nizhny Novgorod. In Ryazan, the concentration camp was also set up in a former nunnery, Kazansky. And here is what they say about it. Imprisoned there were merchants, priests, and so-called war prisoners, as they called captured officers who had not served in the Red Army. But there was also another segment of the prisoner population which fitted into no simple category. For example, the Tolstoyan, I.Y.V, whose trial we have already read about, was kept here. Attached to the camp were workshops, a weaving shop, a tailor shop, a shoemaker's shop, and there was also repair and construction work in the city, general work. In 1921 they were already calling it that. To this, the prisoners were taken by convoy, but those who worked as individual craftsmen, because of the kind of work they did, were allowed to go without convoy, and the citizens fed the latter in their homes. The population of Ryazan was very sympathetic towards the deprivees, as they were called. Officially, they were called not prisoners, but persons deprived of freedom. A passing column of them would be given arms, rusks, boiled beets, potatoes. And the convoy guards did not try to prevent their accepting such gifts, and the deprivees divided everything equally among themselves. At every step, customs not ours, ideology not ours. Those deprivees who were especially fortunate got positions in their specialized fields in institutions. For example, Y.V on the railroad. They then received passes which permitted them to walk around the city, but they spent the night in camp. Here is how they fed them in a camp in 1921. Half a pound of bread, plus another half pound for those who fulfilled the norm, hot water for tea morning and evening, and during the day a ladle of gruel, with several dozen grains and some potato peelings in it. Camp life was embellished on the one hand by the denunciations of provocateurs, and arrests on the basis of the denunciations, and on the other by a dramatics and glee club. They gave concerts for the people of Ryazan in the hall of the former noblemen's assembly, and the deprivees brass band played in the city park. The deprivees got better and better acquainted with and more friendly with the inhabitants, and this became intolerable, and at that point they began to send the so-called war prisoners to the northern special purpose camps. The lesson of the instability and laxity in these concentration camps lay in their being surrounded by civilian life. And that was why the special northern camps were required. Concentration camps were abolished in 1922. This whole dawn of the camps deserves to have its spectrum examined much more closely, and glory to he who can, for all I have in my own hands is crumbs. At the end of the Civil War, the two labor armies created by Trotsky had to be dissolved because of the grumbling of the soldiers kept in them. And by this token, the role of camps in the structure of the RSFSR not only did not diminish, but intensified. By the end of 1920, in the RSFSR, there were 84 camps in 43 provinces. If one believes the official statistics, even though classified, 25,336 persons and, in addition, 24,400 prisoners of war of the Civil War were held in them at this time. Both figures, particularly the second, seem to be understated. However, if one takes into consideration that by unloading prisons, sinking barges, and other types of mass annihilation, the figure had often begun with zero and been reduced to zero over and over, then perhaps these figures are accurate. According to the same source, by October 1923, at the beginning of the cloudless years of NEP, and quite a long time before the personality cult, there were being held, in 355 camps, 68,297 persons deprived of freedom. In 207 reformatories, 48,163. In 105 homes for confinement and prisons, 16,765. In 35 agricultural colonies, 2,328. And another 1,041 minors and sick persons. And there is another expressive figure. On the overcrowding of camps, for the number of those imprisoned grew more swiftly than the organization of camps. For each 100 accommodations for prisoners, there were, in 1924, 112 prisoners. In 1925, 120. In 1926, 132. And in 1927, 177. Whoever has done time there knows well what camp life was like, in terms of places on bunks, bowls in the mess hall, or padded jackets, if there were 1.77 prisoners for each allotted space. Year after year, other forms of existence for prisoners were also tried in a search for something better. For those who were not dangerous and not politically hostile, there were labor colonies, corrective labor homes from 1922, reformatories from 1923, homes for confinement, labor homes from 1924, labor homes for juvenile offenders. And for politically hostile prisoners, there were detention prisons from 1922, and from 1923 on, special purpose isolators, the former centrals and the future special purpose prisons, or TONs. The creators of these forms saw in them a bold struggle against making a fetish of prisons, common to all other countries of the world, including the former Russia, where nobody could think up anything at all except prisons and more prisons. The Tsarist government, which had transformed the entire country into one enormous prison, had developed its prison system with some kind of particularly refined sadism. On the threshold of the Reconstruction period, meaning from 1927, the role of camps was growing. Now, just what was one to think? Now, after all the victories? Against the most dangerous, hostile elements, wreckers, the kulaks, counter-revolutionary propaganda. And so it was that the archipelago was not about to disappear into the depths of the sea. The archipelago would live. Until 1924, there were very few ordinary labor colonies in the archipelago. In those years, closed places of confinement were predominant, and they would not grow less later on. In his report of 1924, Krylenko demanded that the number of special-purpose isolators be increased, isolators for non-workers and for especially dangerous persons among the workers, in which category, evidently, Krylenko himself would turn up later on. This, his formulation, became a part of the corrective labor code of 1924. Just as in the creation of every archipelago, invisible shifts take place somewhere in important supporting strata before the picture of the world emerges before us, so here, too, very important shifts and changes in names took place, which are now nearly incomprehensible to our minds. At the very beginning, there was primeval chaos, and places of imprisonment were under the jurisdiction of three different institutions. The Cheka, Comrade Dzerzhinsky, the NKVD, Comrade Petrovsky, and the People's Commissariat of Justice, Comrade Kursky. In the NKVD at first, there was Gumzak, the Chief Administration for Places of Imprisonment, immediately after October 1917, and then GUPR, the Chief Administration for Forced Labor, and then, once again, GUMS, just as it is today in the 60s. In the People's Commissariat of Justice, there was the Prison Administration, December 1917, then the Central Penal Department, May 1918, with a network of provincial penal departments and even congresses of them, September 1920. And this was then made to sound better as the Central Corrective Labor Department, 1921. It goes without saying that such dispersal was to the disadvantage of the punitive corrective business, and Dzerzhinsky sought the unification of administrations. And, as it happened, at this point a little noticed merging of the Cheka into the NKVD took place. After March the 16th, 1919, Dzerzhinsky became the Commissar of Internal Affairs as well, and by 1922 he had also succeeded in transferring all places of imprisonment from the People's Commissariat of Justice to himself in the NKVD, June the 25th, 1922. And thus, GUMS of the NKVD kept ever expanding. Parallel to this took place the reorganization of the camp guards. First, these were the armies of the VOKHR, the Internal Guard Service of the Republic, and then VNUS, the Internal Service. And in 1919 they were merged into the core of the Chika, and Dzerzhinsky became the chairman of their military council as well. Nonetheless, up until 1924 there were complaints about the numerous escapes, the low state of discipline among the personnel. Probably there were drunkenness and carelessness. Their only interest lay in getting their wages. And it was only in June 1924 that by decree of VTSIK and the Council of People's Commissars, military discipline was introduced into the corps of convoy guards, and recruitment of them through the People's Commissariat for the Army and Navy was inaugurated. And furthermore, parallel to this, a central bureau of dactyloscopic registration and a central breeding establishment for service and tracking dogs were created in 1922. But at this same time, Gumzak of the USSR was renamed GUITU, Chief Administration of Corrective Labor Institutions of the USSR, and then was renamed again GUITL of the OGPU, the Chief Administration of Corrective Labor Camps. And its chief simultaneously became the Chief of Convoy Troops of the USSR. And how much excitement there was, and how many of those stairs, offices, guards, passes, rubber stamps, seals, and signs there were. And from GUITL, the son of Gumzak, derived our own Gulag. Chapter 2. The Archipelago Rises from the Sea. On the White Sea, where the nights are white for half a year at a time, Bolshoi-Solovetsky Island lifts its white churches from the water within the ring of its bouldered Kremlin walls, rusty red from the lichens which have struck root there, and the greyish-white Solovetsky seagulls hover continually over the Kremlin and screech. In all this brightness, it is as if there were no sin present. It is as if nature here had not yet matured to the point of sin, is how the writer Prizhvin perceived the Solovetsky Islands. And to Prizhvin only, the monks themselves seemed sinful in the context of Solovki. It was 1908, and in accordance with the liberal concepts of the times, it was quite impossible to say an approving word about the clergy. And yet to us, who have survived the archipelago, those monks certainly seem angels, though having every opportunity of eating their bellies full, they, in the Golgotha Crucifixion Monastery, permitted themselves fish, itself a fast dish, only on the great holidays. Despite the opportunity to sleep whenever they pleased, they kept vigil nights on end and, in that same small monastery, day-long, year-long, and in perpetuity read the Psalter around the clock and prayed for all Orthodox Christians, living and dead. Without us, these isles rose from the sea. Without us, they acquired a couple of hundred lakes replete with fish. Without our help, they were settled by capercaillies, hares, and deer, while foxes, wolves, and other beasts of prey never ever appeared there. The glaciers came and went, the granite boulders littered the shores of the lakes. The lakes froze during the winter nights, the sea howled under the wind and was covered with an icy sludge, and in places froze. The northern lights blazed across half the sky, and it grew bright once again and warm once again, and the fir trees grew and thickened, and the birds cackled and called, and the young deer trumpeted, and the planets circled through all world history, and kingdoms fell and rose, and here there were still no beasts of prey and no human being.
This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.